Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. And it's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddim-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, it is a pretty packed show. So first up, this story. It has been revealed this week that an algorithm being used to determine how much funding older Australians living at home should get has been making quite a few mistakes. So you're going to hear the questions that we have put to the minister in charge.
The objective piece is the application of the rules. That's the part that's standardised.
That's done by an algorithm.
It's done in a standardised way. That's right. There's an application of the aged care rules. The rules
that's
have to
done
apply
by an algorithm,
to,
yes or no?
To everybody equally. There's a mathematical component. That's the nature of a process.
Then, as the US flags new tariffs on Australia and Canberra continues to sell its revised second-hand sub-deal with Washington, you're going to hear from Australia's former ambassador to the US and federal treasurer, Joe Hockey.
The President of the United States is absolutely convinced that tariffs are great. I've argued personally with him on the issue and he's just not for moving.
From the Radio National Breakfast Team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, I wasn't lying when I said that we had a packed show because we're also going to turn to the Ebola crisis in Africa with the BBC's Africa correspondent. And we'll hear about the tension in the UK town of Southampton following an explosive murder trial and footage of the scene that has caused a lot of outrage. All of that a little later on. But first, this story and a pretty extraordinary interview from a government minister. It's been revealed this week that an algorithm used to determine how much government funding older Australians should get to help them live at home has caused dozens of mistakes. In a Senate hearing this week, officials from the Department of Health and Aged Care revealed that they had about 1,000 people wanting a review of their funding assessments, which were made using an algorithm. It's relatively new, and it's come under pretty heavy scrutiny because it does not allow assessors to override its outcome.
Was there a specific consultation where people were specifically consulted on removal of human override?
No.
There wasn't?
No.
So who made the decision to remove human override and when did they make it?
It was a decision of government and it was in the 24-25 budget process.
And that was the First Assistant Secretary in the Access and Home Support Division within the Department of Health, Greg Pugh, taking questions from Greens Senator Penny Allman-Payne. Well, Sam Ray is the Minister for Aged Care and Seniors. And here's his interview with Sally Sarah this morning on Radio National Breakfast.
How did this happen, that human intervention was left out in this important assessment process?
Oh, I think we just need to clarify there. It's not so much that it was left out. We had previously had an assessment process that was not fit for purpose. We had people waiting very long periods of time. At the worst case scenario, people were waiting 10 months just to get their aged care assessment. And what we ended up with was an aged care system where there was essentially $4 billion of unspent funds that could have been better distributed to older people in need of care. So the case for having a much improved assessment system was very clear. The integrated assessment tool to which this discussion pertains, it's the updated system, is a much improved system. It deals with both the classification of people's care needs as well as the prioritisation of care needs. But I want to make a couple of points. Assessments, the clinical component of the assessment is always done by a person. 100% of assessments, aged care assessments, are done by a person, most of them in the person's home itself. And that is about making sure that the highly trained assessors can engage with the older person, engage with their families, and engage with the environment that they're living in to enter the very best data, clinical data, into the system. The automated component that you're talking about is the application of the aged care rules, and the rules have to be the same for everyone. This ensures that across our country, across all of the diverse communities, and indeed across the diverse assessment organisations that actually do the assessments, we get an equitable outcome, we get a fair outcome. We also get an efficient outcome for older people. Now, median wait times are down under a month consistently, so people aren't waiting as long, and we're getting much fairer outcomes.
So there's speed there, but if we're talking about the quality of the decision that's being made, there's not human override there. So humans put in the data, the algorithm makes the decision, but there's not a way to override that.
Again, so the human being does the assessment. They're a highly trained assessor.
That.
After that happens, the data goes into the integrated assessment tool. There's then a second human being, that's the assessor delegate, who then reviews the data against the notes that have been taken through the assessment process, make sure that the input data is right,
So that's reviewing the data, but they don't have override to override the decision.
Well, again, I think we need to understand the clinical data is collected by the
we
clinicians. The laws are made by essentially the Parliament of Australia. So the laws, the rules that govern the system have to be applied equitably to everybody.
There's no room for humans there to understand some of the nuance or if there are any issues there. So that is a algorithm computer-derived decision, correct?
Again, what there are is a set of rules. The rules have to be the same for everyone. Sally, that's how we get an equitable outcome for every older person across our country. The bit that varies in this process, the subjective piece, if you like, is the assessment piece. That's the piece that captures the needs of the older person. And then the objective piece is the application of the rules. So that's the part that's standardised.
That's done by an algorithm.
It's done in a standardised way. That's right. There's an application of the aged care rules. The rules
it's
have to apply.
Done by an algorithm, yes or no?
To everybody equally. There's a component. There's a mathematical component. That's the nature of a process. An algorithm is just a process. There is a process by which the aged care rules are applied. That's an automated process.
So there's no way for a human to override that decision?
Well, as I said, there's the first person who does the assessment.
I understand that part. So if we're just getting to the question, there's no way to override the decision.
Well, I think you need to understand the flow of the process.
I do understand that.
Well, we haven't even got... There's a review process as well. And that's
after the decision?
After the decision, that's right. The person can seek a review of the decision and that then comes back into a separate process. Another human being, a third human being, is part of the review process. I think that's the number that you were referring to that came out of Senate estimates there. We've seen about 0.5% of the total number of assessments go to the review process. In the March quarter, we did over 130,000 assessments. So this is a very large number of assessments that are being completed
so
nationally.
So hundreds of people are appealing their reviews. Could there be more mistakes or cases we don't know about here?
Well, the system can always be better, Sally, and that's what this reform program is all about, making the system better for older people. And Minister Butler and I made an announcement yesterday about another improvement. As I said, we think the integrated assessment tool is a significant improvement on the previous assessment system, but I'm not satisfied with the prioritisation mechanism. That's a component of that tool. So I've asked the department to conduct a rapid review and give us their findings within 3 months so that we can continue to make the changes to this system that get the very best outcomes for older people.
What were the financial savings from using this algorithm?
This has not been based on any financial savings. This is based on getting the best outcomes. This is a generational reform program. The government's investments in aged care are the greatest that our country has ever seen. We've seen investment in the aged care system rise by more than 40% since we were elected just in the last 4 years.
So in terms of improving this system or streamlining it, there were no savings here. Was it worth your while? What advantage has it produced?
This is getting much better outcomes than the old system. We're getting fairer outcomes for older people. We're getting more efficient outcomes for older people. We're making sure that there's an equitable distribution of our aged care services and that care gets to the people who need it most.
That is Sam Ray there, the Minister for Aged Care and Seniors, discussing this system and some of the errors that it's made. The government, though, still standing by it. Well, we woke up this morning to what feels a little bit like deja vu. The United States proposing higher tariffs on Australia and dozens of other economies. Here's how the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, responded to the news on the ABC's AM program.
There is an ideological disagreement where the United States administration has broken with what was a decades-long understanding that tariffs are not positive for the country that is imposing them. that they increase the costs of goods and services in the country that is applying them to its consumers, and that free trade is in the interests of the global economy. It's in the interests of Australia. It's also in the interests of the United States.
Anthony Albanese there. So in response, we invited on the former Australian ambassador to the United States and the former Liberal treasurer, Joe Hockey, and he gave Sally his impression of the planned tax hike.
No surprise at all, Sally. Look, the President of the United States is absolutely convinced the tariffs are great. I've argued personally with him on the issue, and he's just not for moving. He just can't see the inflationary impact and the negative impact on American consumers. And it just goes to show how the world's on its head when a left-wing Labor Prime Minister is trying to convince a right-wing Republican president that free trade is actually the right way to go.
On the AUKUS deal, at the National Press Club last week, you said you were having doubts for the first time about the ability of the US to deliver Virginia-class subs on schedule. Does the decision this week to purchase 3 second-hand subs rather than 1 new and 2 second-hand, does that allay some of your concerns?
Well, it does. And, you know, it was more than 2 years ago during the presidential election, I was repeatedly asked about how Donald Trump would react to the AUKUS deal, and I said at the time, he'll confirm the deal, but say don't give him the new ones. Now, that's played out exactly as I predicted. And look, from a military perspective, I think it works well that we have a single platform. But I think, Sally, you know, it's really important to remember why we need submarines. They are a massive deterrent. During World War II, we didn't have them. Japanese submarines came into Sydney Harbour. And now 42% of the world's iron ore goes out of the Pilbara. You know, the world's biggest coal port, whether you like it or not, is Newcastle, sending energy into Asia. We now have 10 different ports exporting the biggest amount of LNG in the world to our region. And if we don't protect those ports, which we've never had to do before, if we don't protect them with submarines, then we are going to be massively exposed, as the battle in the Strait of Hormuz currently indicates.
That is the former Australian ambassador to the US and former Liberal Treasurer Joe Hockey discussing the proposed new tariffs on Australia and also this week's developments regarding the AUKUS submarine program. A couple really big international stories this week, including what's been happening in the United Kingdom. We've seen violent protests erupt in the town of Southampton over the police's handling of the murder of teenager Henry Novak in December. Now, it's become a huge story this week because 23-year-old Vikram Digwa was just sentenced to life in prison for stabbing the 18-year-old student to death. The body cam footage released by the police shows an extraordinary scene. Henry being handcuffed while telling police, "I can't breathe," and saying repeatedly that he'd been stabbed, and then police dismissing him. All after Digwa lied to officers at the scene of the stabbing, claiming he'd been the victim of a racist attack. The story has captured the British public. It's drawn outrage from members of the public, even Number 10, and it spurred really violent scenes in the town of Southampton, protesters marching on the police headquarters, and then trying to get to the scene of the crime before they were blocked by the cops. Some of the people speaking at the protests made extreme claims, saying this was about white and non-whites, calling for mass deportations and for Christianity to return to the centre of British life. But Henry's family, while frustrated and grieving, have called for their son's death to not be used to fuel division.
Instead of being treated as a dying victim, police formally arrested Henry for assault and read him his rights. That was the last thing he heard. Henry did not die with dignity. He did not die with the care he deserved. He lost consciousness before anyone believed him.
We do not want his death to be used to create further division, hatred, or tension. We want his story to make our streets safer for everyone.
Mark Novak speaking outside the court earlier this week. Danny Shaw once advised the UK Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper. He's now a commentator on policing, and he told Sally how this case is being seen in the UK.
Oh, I mean, the reaction has been extraordinary. I mean, people are shocked and really troubled by the video footage that's emerged of Henry Novak's, you know, last few minutes before he died, with the police officer not believing him, putting him in handcuffs, and, you know, not giving him any help or calling for help until eventually, you know, he realized that he wasn't faking. And it's distressing to watch that, and it must be awful for just words cannot imagine what it must be like for Henry's family, who've, you know, they've lost their son, their loved one, in the worst possible circumstances, and then to know that the police officer treated you as a suspect in your last dying moments, just awful.
What's the response been like on the streets of Southampton and elsewhere?
Well, there was a very strong protest and a very vociferous protest that became violent on the streets of Southampton, the city where the murder took place last night in UK time on Tuesday night. And, you know, at least 11 police officers were injured. A police dog was injured. A police officer, you know, narrowly avoided very serious injury when I think an e-scooter was thrown towards her. So, you know, you can understand people's anger about what's happened and the need to sort of protest. But when that spills into violence, it's completely unacceptable.
What are the undercurrents that have ignited here?
What this case it has been used as by some political leaders is an example, they say, of two-tier policing. That is to say, a policing culture and style that treats white people more severely or unfairly compared to people from ethnic minorities. And that is what people are saying. Henry Novak was a white man, and the perpetrator was Sikh, an Asian male who pretended that he was the victim in this, that he was the victim of a racial assault, which was a complete and utter lie. And so what people are sort of saying is that the police have been taken in by some of the kind of anti-racism agenda in policing, to the extent that they would rather deal with an incident of racial hatred than have to deal with someone who had been stabbed. That is the allegation, and it has been stirred up by the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, and other people as well, as part of this agenda of two-tier justice, two-tier policing, in which white people are unfairly treated in the criminal justice system in the UK. My own view is that that is wrong, completely wrong, and that is not the case. I don't believe that there is two-tier policing, but I do believe that the police made a terrible mistake in this case.
Danny Shaw there, a police commentator and former advisor to the UK Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper. We're going to end on the Ebola crisis in Africa because protests have erupted in central Kenya. Now, don't worry, you haven't missed anything. There aren't actually any cases that have been recorded in Kenya. The protests are in response to a US plan to establish a quarantine facility at a military base to treat US citizens. Two people have reportedly been shot dead in the protests. Meanwhile, over in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there have been more than 300 confirmed cases of Ebola and dozens of deaths. Now, there's been a big drop in the earlier estimates, but aid groups are still worried that it could become the most deadly outbreak in history. If you've ever listened to the BBC, you've probably heard Barbara Pledusher's voice. She's the BBC's Africa correspondent. Now, for a long time, Sally Sarah also reported from there as the ABC's Africa correspondent. So take a listen to this really insightful conversation between them about this crisis in Central Africa that is causing political ruptures in East Africa.
What's sparking this backlash?
What's sparking this, these protests are a decision by the Kenyan government to reach agreement with the U.S. to set up a quarantine facility in the town. The quarantine facility would be at a military Air Force base, which is located near the town. The news leaked from the U.S. The government didn't announce it or explain to locals what was going on. And so there has been a backlash as a result for different reasons. The people who were coming out on the street, they said they didn't feel safe. They said, we don't have Ebola in the country. Why do we want to bring it in? And why do we want to bring foreigners, especially Americans, in if they have the Ebola virus? They should be able to quarantine in the Democratic Republic of Congo or Uganda or somewhere else. So there's a basic fear. There's some misinformation. Because of COVID, there's some belief that this can be spread by the air, which it can't. It can be spread by body fluids. And really, it has to meet a sort of a cut or a membrane or something like that. So it doesn't spread as easily. But even those who understand that say, look, we have children at a school near there. How do we know that it isn't going to spread? So that's the reaction on the street. And that there has been some similar reaction from the medical union, which essentially said, if the Americans are going to send their sick here, why do we need to take them? They should send them back to America. If it's too dangerous for America, it's too dangerous for us.
Barbara, do we know why the US wants to set up this isolation center in Kenya specifically, why it's not doing it somewhere else?
Well, that's a very good question, because it's a change in policy. So during the previous Ebola outbreak in 2014 in West Africa, those US, mostly health workers really, who were exposed to the virus were brought back to the US. And there they were able to get very high-standing medical care in the disease control centers that the U.S. has. So this has been questioned in Congress by former U.S. health officials and also by the Democrats. What the Trump administration says is they want someplace close by because they don't want to have to take a long flight. Kenya is close by, and it has a very good relationship on health agreements with the Kenyans. But they also do stress again and again that they will not allow any Ebola cases into the U.S. This is very much their top line.
Barbara, just finally, what's the broader picture here for the United States and its relationship more broadly with Africa? We know that under the Trump administration, there'd been very significant cuts to international aid. Has this current situation emphasised to US officials the importance of having some underlying relationships and pre-positioning of equipment experts and cultivating that relationship with African nations before a crisis unfolds?
Well, it's a good question because the Trump administration has withdrawn from the WHO, saying that it's inefficient and wasteful. And it has also, I'm sure as your listeners know, dismantled its main development agency last year, the USAID, in a very sudden way, which disrupted all kinds of networks that USAID had. I was speaking to a former CDC official today, that's the Center for Disease Control, a former U.S. one, and he said, look, when we had responses to Ebola in the past, it was very much the CDC working together with the USAID because they could do the logistics. They could reach out to the community while we did this sort of medical analysis and so on. So that has, according to many people on the ground and also analysts, that has had an impact in terms of the response. Now, the Americans have said that they are responding, that they have allocated $112 million bilaterally, and that they've also allocated money to the UN. So they are operating multilaterally, dealing with the UN, which of course is a member of the WHO. So it's a little bit something to watch, I suppose.
Barbara, I've been a great admirer of your coverage from so many parts around the world for many years. Thank you so much for taking some time to speak to us on Breakfast this morning.
You're very welcome.
And that is the wonderful Barbara Platt-Usher there, the BBC's Africa correspondent, speaking to Sally Sara from Nairobi in Kenya. And that is it for the Breakfast Wrap for today. Oscar Coleman produced today's episode. Before we go, I want to let you know what we've got in the works for tomorrow.
You've previously blown the whistle on KPMG.
A whistleblower at accounting firm KPMG has alleged that confidential client information was improperly accessed and shared among partners. Tomorrow, you're going to hear the interviews that we've done on this across the week, including with a former KPMG whistleblower. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll see you tomorrow.